Okay, we're going to jump right into it. So, Rob, what did your father do for a living?
What did my father do for a living? My father had a small printing company in New York called Flair Printing, which was on 8 West 45th, 45th just off 5th. And it was a business he started in 1960, 2 years before I was born. And he did it my whole life growing up in New York up until about 1990.
And you grew up in Manhattan, right?
No, I grew up in Yonkers, two blocks outside of the Bronx. I was born in Mount Sinai Hospital, so I was born in Manhattan, but I grew up basically in Yonkers.
But I know you went to the same school as Jason Flom, right?
Yeah, Jason Flom and I were both Fielston class of 79. It's a true story. I met Jason freshman year. Fielston has two feeder schools, a grammar school called Fielston Lower, which is the one I went to, and another grammar school called Ethical in Midtown Manhattan, which is what Jason went to, I think. So Jason and I first met in seventh grade in Mrs. Leischer's homeroom, and I remember it vividly because one of the first days of school, Jason walked in with a T-shirt. This is 1973, I think, with a T-shirt of one pig on top of another one that said, "Making Bacon." And Mrs. Leischer made Jason go home and get a different shirt.
So he was a troublemaker from day one. Were you friendly with Jason then?
Jason and I were always like friendly but not best buddies. We were in different circles. I was like Jason. I've learned subsequently as we've become much closer as adults. Part of why I didn't see him a lot latter part of high school is he spent a lot of time at the track, which I think he's talked about subsequently. So Jason spent the latter part of his high school years in a very different arc than I spent on mine, and we reconnected later in life.
Okay, so were you a science kid from day one?
I was more of a math kid than a science kid. I was one of these kids who just numbers like always made sense to me. I grew up a baseball fan, and to me, like, baseball was statistics. So, like, I literally would study way before sabermetrics or way before any of this stuff became popular. I would know everybody's batting average to the fourth decimal point. I just numbers kind of made sense to me, and I was like a numbers kid. I also like media. I mean, one of my favorite things to do was listening to WABC radio as a kid. I just felt like radio was like this window to the whole wide universe. This is, you know, at the time I didn't have a shortwave or a radio, and it was obviously way before other stuff I ended up doing. But I was like media, especially music. Started a radio station when I was in high school, so I was the fact that my life ended up connecting to music, even though I have very, very poor skills as a performer. I played cello for 2 years and piano for a couple years, and I suck at both of them. But I love music, and music and math were two of my passions growing up.
And was that encouraged in your household?
Yeah, both were. I mean, I have a sister who's 2 years older, and she was a really good pianist and is a good musician. She went to Oberlin, the liberal arts part, but she spent a lot of time with her buddies in the conservatory. She went to music camp. So she's quite a good musician, or was quite a good musician, probably still is. I was like the math kid. And so we kind of each gave each other our own turfs kind of deal. My parents were like, they were both the first in their families to go to college. They were very much focused on pushing us in academic directions, but in
a little Jewish family.
Well, my mom's Catholic, my dad's Jewish. So
really? Were you raised Jewish? Or?
No, it was great. Double majored in guilt.
Well, the woman you're married to now, is she Jewish?
I've actually done multiple religions. I've married a Jew and I've married a Catholic woman. So I haven't done Buddhist yet. But
I'll, okay.
But my current partner grew up Catholic. So, yes, I've gone back to Catholicism, but you can only marry one, I'm told. Although the Pope's kind of changed that, I think. But anyway, the role of religion, we had a Christmas tree, which was kind of almost a cultural thing. But we were mostly, my mom was from California, so I didn't really know as closely the Catholic side of the family. I knew the Jewish relatives. My dad's brother lived in Long Island, and we would do holidays with them. So I was, and Fielston's probably like a third Jewish, so I was in touch with kind of both sides of my heritage.
Okay, I have to ask though, if your mother was from California, how'd your father meet her?
It's actually an awesome story. So my dad and my mom met at a folk dancing place in 1953 or 1954, I think. And my dad and his best friend, Bob Orenbach, and my mom and her best friend, Felice, both went to this place, and three lifelong couples were formed that night. So my mom and my dad met, Felice met her husband Roger, and Bob met his wife Audrey all the same night. So I don't know what was in the tequila there that night, but something magical. And they all married for life, which was just pretty amazing.
And what was folk dancing? Did they ever tell you what actually transpired at this venue?
There were no videotapes at the time, so there's very subjective recollections of it. But it was a meaningful night, obviously, for all six of them. And relative to my parents were married over 50 years until my dad passed away 5 years ago, and so they had a great long run out of it.
Okay, so if you're born in 1962, you're in high school when the Apple II comes out.
Yes.
Were you an adherent of computers in high school?
I was, but not through PCs. I was a little before and a little after in a funny way. So my first computer was a programmable TI-58 computer. Which was not a computer at all. It was a calculator with 240 steps in it. So you had to learn how to write really efficient code. And that was the first computing device that I owned. And you could program it to do sort of simulation kinds of things. It had a little display. I couldn't afford the expensive one with magnetic cards, but I was able to save my money from shoveling snow and raking leaves and other stuff to where I got the printer so I could actually save my programs and type them back in meticulously, all 240 instructions of them. Then my senior year in high school, Fieldston started time sharing on another computer down the street at a school called Riverdale. And so that was when I first got into any sort of serious interactive programming. It was a PDP 1134 that ran an obscure operating system called RISTUS, for any nerds out there. And the biggest thing that I did there was I wrote a game that simulated running a presidential election called Prez, and it became very popular, and I leveraged that popularity, and I put a Trojan horse in it that gave me system access to the entire computer system.
Okay, and did you utilize that access to do bad or good?
I utilized it because back in the day, hacker meant something different than it means now. Hacker meant somebody who had the curiosity, the pioneer spirit. Stephen Levy's book, Hacker, describes this. And it was about, like, climbing the mountain, the digital version of the mountain. So I never did anything malicious. I would basically, there were fun games on the system that you could play if you had access to them. I would do that. So the worst you could say is that I stole some CPU cycles from the Riverdale computer. I did it with a buddy, I won't say his name, but he ended up being a professor at MIT and a very accomplished person in his own right. So apparently we were not too bad. But we had fun, and I learned a lot about programming computers and I can tell you a lot about bad computer operating system security and Trojan horses, because RISTUS did not have robust security.
So that computer terminal that you had access to, the mainframe or mini computer, whatever it was, that was at school.
That was in high school. That was my first experience. My first experience in owning a computer was in 1981 when the IBM PC came out. But I was already in college.
Okay, but before you're in college, so when you're at Fieldston, would you stay after school to use that computer? Would you track your relationship with a computer in school somewhat similarly to what Bill Gates says his experience was?
So I didn't, in between the programmable calculator that I owned and my access to the PDP 1134 through a time-sharing terminal, I don't know if I got my full 10,000 hours in, but I definitely got a decent amount of computing experience. We also, by the way, we had a PDP, I forgot, my whole sky school had a PDP 8 before the PDP 1134, which had a 110 baud teletype, you know, the old, like, you know, something out of 2001 with the keys clanging and the loud teletype. The only thing about that was the computer would reboot when you plugged the coffee pot in, so it really wasn't that robust a computer. So I dinked around with that a little bit, but it was really the my own calculator and the other one were my main computing experience.
And you know, I'm a little bit older than you. I was born in 1953, and there are people who are younger, but there was really class division in my high school, but it was much larger than your high school. When you're pursuing your love of computers, does that make you an ostracized nerd, or does that include you in the class?
So I had different things I did. So before I started this, I started a radio station in my high school, and that was fun. I just did it because I loved radio. Actually, when I was 12, I went to a summer camp, and my camp counselor was a DJ at WNYC, I think it was, the city college. college station, and I thought it was
Was that a classical station back then?
No. This was it. Was like an all format station. It was the WCC. It was the City College of New York station. So not NYC, CCNY or something like that. And so I went and visited his radio station that next fall, and I thought it was the coolest thing in the world. So I got my we ended up setting up a intercom radio station in high school. I did that when I was like a sophomore, junior.
How much technical know-how did that know, or was more the inspiration?
It was more the inspiration. It wasn't super technical. I mean, it was literally we didn't get a low wattage license. We just literally wired the building from the room we were in to the gymnasium and the cafeteria. So it was basically doing radio over wired lines. Basically, what I ended up doing 20 years later when we started Real Networks, but the internet didn't exist then, so we just wired it ourselves.
Okay, so you end up going to Yale. Where else did you apply to college?
I actually only applied to two places. I applied to Yale and a little college in Iowa called Grinnell.
Right.
And the reason I applied to Grinnell was I thought, after being growing up in New York and thinking I didn't necessarily want to, like, you know, follow all the whole sort of snobby elitist kind of stuff that you associate with the Northeast and the Ivies. One of the inventors of the integrated circuit, one of the early people at Intel, was a Grinnell graduate. And so in the late 70s, Grinnell had one of the best funded computer science facilities of any small liberal arts college in the country. And I went and visited Grinnell, had a lovely time, was super fun, but I made the purely pragmatic decision that if I hated Yale and I wanted to switch to Grinnell, they would have me with open arms. Whereas if I went the other way and I turned down Yale, went to Grinnell and tried to get back into Yale, they'd flip me the bird. So I figured the right thing to do was to pick the one. I liked them both, and I picked the one that seemed like if I didn't like it, I could switch to the other one. And I ended up having a great time.
So you did have a good experience in college.
Fantastic. By the time I went there, I felt really good about it. My sister, who was 2 years older, one of her friends were going to Yale. I went up and hung out with them, and it was a revelation to find a place where, like, being a nerd was kind of cool, or at least not as ostracized as it. Not ostracized too strong. It was not in the cultural mainstream of my high school to be a nerd. Like, it was, but whereas in college, it was a college full of nerds, so it felt they were different kinds of nerds, not all computer nerds, some. Or math nerds, different things. The other thing was helpful is, so in I was good at math, but there was a kid named Paul Quintus who was the best in math in my school. And there were a few of us. Jason was, before he started becoming a stoner, was super smart at math too. There were a few of us who were like vied for second best in math. So I never had the image that I had to become a pure mathematician. But then at Yale, I started, okay, I'm going to see what I can do. So I started in the early concentration math program, which was like the hardest program. You had to take the AP and all that stuff to get in. And it started out with about 15 people in it. And after 2 weeks, everybody had dropped out except for me and five guys who knew each other from math camp, which I had not gone to. So I was nerdy, but not uber nerdy, I guess. And it was really a revelation for me because I was clearly the worst of the six of us. And it was a really good thing to learn that, at the age of, I was still 17, I think, didn't turn 18 yet, that I would not be hurting society by not being a theoretical mathematician, because there were five people in the room with me who were far better theoretical mathematicians than me just in that one room in one class at Yale. So it was a liberation for me that I could go do other stuff that built on the fact that I was pretty good at math without having to go the purist route, which, of course, academia almost always steers you towards, like, if you're really, really good, you do the purest form of something. And then if you're not able to cut it in the purest thing, you can do something more philistine, like be in business. So for me, I got that feedback early on, and it was quite liberating for me.
Okay, so you wake up one day and you say you're not going to be the head of the class in math. What are your other interests in college?
So I combined a bunch of things. I was always in media, but in college I did it by getting involved in the student newspaper, the Yale Daily News. I got involved in student activism. I was pretty politically active because 1979, 1980 was when Reagan came in. There was a lot of saber rattling going on. I didn't like that very much. So I was sort of a student activist in a bunch of anti-militaristic, anti-jingoistic, anti-Reagan kinds of things in college. And through that, I got involved with writing editorials in the student newspaper. And a bunch of these my friends were like, hey, we like you. Would you write a column for us? And so I wrote a column for 2 or 3 years in college called What's Left. And then the funny thing about it is the guy who wrote the column Right of Way, he's actually become a good friend of mine, a guy named David Frum. So really? David and I wrote.
I didn't know that David Frum went to Yale.
David was I would like the point counterpoint of this, you know. And so I wrote the left wing column. He wrote the right wing column. I think I wrote one that was had a kind of a headline that was a little nasty, as I recall. It was Frum: distortions, misrepresentations, and lies. But we've since buried the hatchet on that. And
well, he's also moved left.
Well, he's moved sensible, at least I would say. And he and I, when I got involved many years later in a bunch of stuff around Putin and Trump, David was one of the first people I talked to about it, and he wrote a long piece in The Atlantic about it. And so our lives have intertwined in a funny way. In college, we were had pretty different views, and then after doing penance for the whole axis of evil thing, because he's famously the person who coined that phrase. He's now obviously changed his views of that part of the Republican Party anyway.
So you say you got your first computer at 19,
yeah,
an IBM PC. What was the inspiration for that?
So luck always plays a role in life. So in the summer of 81, I went to work for IBM in Poughkeepsie, New York. It was
a little slower. So this is right after freshman year of college?
After sophomore year.
After sophomore year. So how did you even get that gig?
It's actually an interesting thing. So I did some computer programming I ended up doing a computer science degree and then a master's degree in economics. So I was sort of straddling between those two fields.
Okay, wait, but just you start with math.
Right.
In 1981, to what degree at Yale is there a computer science program?
Yale had a good but small computer science program. It's not as large as certainly MIT's or one of the other schools, but it had some really good professors. One of the pioneers of early programming language, a guy named Alan Perlis, who's since passed away. Some really interesting people in there, but it was a small program. I don't know, there were maybe 15, 20 of us majors, maybe a little more than that. And so I was doing computer science stuff, and then I was doing economics. And one of the virtues of having done advanced math is you can start doing advanced economics earlier, because basically the only difference, as I could see, between the graduate and the undergraduate economic classes is the graduate economic classes assumed calculus in economics, so I was able to kind of...
Did you have any vision of who or what you wanted to do or be?
I think I knew I wanted to do something at the intersection of technology, media, and politics. But what the manifestation of that would be, and the fact that it's ended up involving more technology and media professionally, and more politics as an avocation rather than a vocation, is sort of kind of how it evolved. Part of it is when you do computer stuff, you can get decent summer jobs that pay reasonably well. And I applied for a summer job at IBM in the summer of 81, and because one of the jobs I had at school involved doing programming on an IBM mainframe. Also, my first paid job, I worked at NYU the summer after my senior year in high school working on their computer. So I did that.
And doing what on their computers?
It was a computer for the admissions department. So I was just doing regular sort of random programming assignments, writing reports for a basic four mini computer that the NYU admissions department had as their in-house.
Okay, system. When you were at Fieldston, was there a teacher who taught you this stuff, or were you all self-taught?
In terms of computer science, there were no teachers, so I taught myself programming. But if you know math and you're technically inclined, I didn't find learning programming was that hard. So my first actual course in programming was freshman year in college, probably.
And what was the language then?
We learned everything from C, that was before C++, C to APL, which was kind of obscure symbolic language, Lisp, which was a natural language programming. I did some programming in Fortran, which was for these applied jobs. BASIC is obviously the presidential election simulator / Trojan horse was written in BASIC, BASIC was probably the first higher level language I wrote in.
Okay, so what is your gig after your sophomore year at IBM?
So I worked at IBM in a really boring job in Poughkeepsie, New York, in a group that wrote. IBM had a language called GCL that was a language to batch program computers, and I came in I just missed having to work on punch cards. I'm really lucky in that. But this was they had a language called Joule. Don't know why I remember that, because it's a pretty obscure language that generated GCL. So my job was to write programs in Joule that were used for some set of maintenance programs for the mainframe group. The reason it wasn't super boring is one of the guys in my group that I was in Poughkeepsie, New York, happened to be part of the task force that was working on the IBM PC. So I get there in June. Again, lucky is better than good all the time. I get there in June, or late May, early June. I'm there about a month. The IBM PC gets announced. And I ask this guy, Jim, And he knows everything there was to know about it. So he tells me all about it. And I get super excited. I was never an Apple II kid, as I mentioned. I kind of sort of generationally didn't quite line up with that. But I thought the IBM PC seemed like it was going to be a really good thing in terms of like taking the PC industry to the next level. And you could say legitimizing it. Famously, Steve Jobs and Apple once ran an ad, you know, where they said that if people say the IBM PC is going to legitimize personal computing, well, the bastards say welcome. So that was a famous ad Apple ran in 1981. But it did have that vibe, that feel in the culture. And this is going back, you know, 37 years now. And so I, after I finished my job, summer job, with a bunch of buddies, decided to start a little software company, which I called Ivy Research, to make games for the IBM PC.
So, okay. So the IBM PC, I've already forgotten, is introduced exactly when?
It came out, it was announced in the summer of 81, and it first became available early in the fall.
So when you start this Ivy company, yeah, are you saying, oh, this will be fun, or you see dreams of riches?
A little bit of both, but really more, it'll be fun and we'll learn a lot, and maybe it'll become something. So basically bought one PC, which I think I used most of my summer job money to buy. I think one of the other guys bought the printer or something like that. There were originally half a dozen of us that got excited about it. There were three of us who ended up working on it full time. So my summer job in the summer of 82, other than doing a little political organizing, which I could talk about, was to write games for the IBM PC. And the game, we wrote two games. My friend Steve was a better programmer than me, so he wrote the libraries for both of them, and I wrote one of them, and he wrote the other. They were called Slinks and Viper. And Slinks is basically, you know, the old snake game on the Nokia candy bar phone? It was that game. And it may have been the first incarnation of it. I've never heard of an older one. But it was the notion that you run around a maze, you pick up tokens, and the more tokens you get, the longer the snake gets. And the goal is to get the snake to be as long as possible without tripping into yourself. It's a fun game. And that was one of our games. And we sold them nationally through a chain of computer stores called Computerland. So I mentioned all these old defunct names. And if you do the math on it, the three of us made enough money to make it a good summer job, but not a life-changing event. So it was like, basically the summer of 82 and then a little bit into the fall, and then I got busy getting ready to graduate and finishing all my schoolwork.
We'll take a quick break and come back with more of my conversation with CEO of Real Networks, Rob Glaser. Recorded live at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California. This week, I'm speaking with Real Network's Rob Glaser. Over the last couple of months, I've interviewed Tony Hawk and the head of music for YouTube and Google, Lior Cohn. Be the first to hear next week's episode by subscribing to the podcast on TuneIn, Apple Podcasts, or your podcast app of choice. While you're there, please rate and review the podcast. Okay, let's get back to my conversation with Rob Glaser. Okay, so you have the experience with the IBM PC, you graduate, and then you go to graduate school?
No, I was lucky. Because of my head start in math, I was able to do the master's degree in economics concurrent with the bachelor's degree in computer science, so I was able to do all that in 4 years.
And what was your thinking getting a master's in economics?
So I thought about whether or not I wanted to go get a PhD in economics, and I didn't know, I loved the questions that economics addresses. How do we create a just society? What's the source of wealth? What's the fairest way to distribute things? How do markets work? But I didn't end up liking the methodology that academia uses in economics. It seemed very abstract and ahistorical by and large. So I really, by the time I graduated, I thought I'm just going to go out in the world. But my master's thesis was on the job market for academic economists. Because I thought, it's a market, right? And I thought, how can I learn about what it's like to be an academic economist? Well, I know, I'll write a paper about them. So I did a survey about how the market worked and how the structure of the market worked. And by then I was clear I didn't want to go do that. So I thought about what I was going to do next.
So what did you determine? What was the market for academic economists?
It's a very self-referential market. In other words, it's a market where reputation carries a huge amount of weight. And you look at the feedback loop of which graduate programs place people in which academic institutions. Now, this was, 35 years ago, 1983, so it may have changed, although I doubt it, that you know, over a long period of time, you might say the cream rises to the top. But insofar as the best people go to the best schools, it's fine, but it tends to provide a lot of sort of feedback around orthodoxy, where the best professors, best students get the best jobs as sort of the pattern that emerged, which is...
Okay, at this late date, there's a huge division between the left and the right. We read Paul Krugman, the New York Times, says one thing, and we have all the economists backing up the right wing. What's your viewpoint on this?
On the degree to which economics it can be used as a justification. Right now, we're in it's a very weird world because we're in such a world where the division is not between the academic left and the academic right. It's between people who are science and fact-based and people who are know-nothings. So know-nothings in the old American tradition of know-nothings. So when you look at the degree to which the tax cut, for instance, is being justified on academic economic grounds, that's not really the case anymore. You look at the deficits, right? The fact that the right wing said they hate deficits, but they've now passed the tax bill that's going to blow up the deficit to a higher level than it's ever been before at a faster rate than you've ever seen outside of an economic depression ever. So right now, I actually don't really think when you look at what's going on in the economy, it was a strong economy before Trump. They've added a little bit of put some more sugar in the coffee to make it even sweeter, not doing it in a way that's sustainable. I don't think most academic economists would say that that's what you should have done, but people who like low tax rates for corporations are very happy.
And staying on the same point of know-nothings and fact-based, is there any hope for America, both in terms of the top level arguing and the people, you know, in the hinterlands moving back towards facts, or are we on this divergent path and it will sustain?
I think it could go either way. I mean, I'm pretty generally an optimist, but in the present time, you've always had political divisions in this country, and I didn't like Reagan very much, although in hindsight, the worst thing he did in terms of creating a huge military conflict was invading Grenada. So, that was a pretty, that was a pretty mild thing to do. He knocked over a few palm trees and, maybe one or two people got their noses broken or something. But compared to, some of the really bad wars we've had since then, it wasn't that pernicious. Then you had George W. Bush, who, did some really horrible things, but ultimately the system worked and the pendulum swung back. And then with Obama, I think what happened was there were a lot of people who got freaked out by the fact that this the visual change of having an African American president, which in my view was a sign of society being a fundamentally healthy place and a very positive thing, and I still think he's the best president of my lifetime, but that there were a lot of people who were really freaked out about that, and that created an environment where you look at...
And they were freaked out about what?
The fact that somebody who doesn't look like them got to be president.
Okay.
And whether it's because there's all these studies that are coming out now that status anxiety was a huge motivator of a lot of the Trump supporters. And status anxiety has an economic element to it, but also...
Why don't you explain what status anxiety is?
Well, basically the people are afraid that they're not going to be able to maintain their life situation, be it financially or be it social prestige. And those kinds of fears get played on in all kinds of different ways by people who are fearmongers or various kinds of dog whistleblowers. And a lot of what happened with Trump has been a lot of that sort of rhetoric, in my view, combined with the fact that when the economic recovery happened, there's all these things that happened with 2016, but it was when the economic recovery happened, it happened on the coast very well, and it happened in the middle country much less comprehensively. And a lot of people that had solid middle-class lives with union jobs, they don't have those union jobs anymore. And ironically, the economy is getting gutted in a way that makes it much, much harder for people that aren't college educated and are living in the wealthier coastal cities to make it. And that created an environment where people who were jingoistic or people who were willing to manipulate the truth to sort of create boogeymen are able to do that.
Okay, so you graduate from college, you decide you don't want to be an academic economist, don't want to be an economist at all, so what do you do?
Well, I had, two or three different job choices, and they were pretty interesting. I could have stayed with the little Ivy Research company that made those games, and we were working on some consulting projects that turned into some interesting things. My friend Steve stayed with that, but I decided I wanted to do something where I could learn a lot more about scale. And so I had a couple job offers at Hewlett-Packard, which I thought was a... I didn't want to go to IBM. I thought it was too bureaucratic and too organized around, like, people whose, you know, in intensity level and intellect and like were more sort of within one standard deviation of the norm than a place where if you really wanted to throw yourself into it, you could have a huge impact. And IBM is a great company in a lot of ways, but at that point it had gotten pretty big and bureaucratic. So Hewlett-Packard, I had a couple of opportunities there. I thought it was an interesting place. And then Steve Ballmer and Paul Allen went to Yale and interviewed people from Microsoft. And I knew a little bit about I knew more about the PC than the average college kid in 1982, 1983. So I interviewed with them, and they, you know,
a little bit slower. Did you know them previously?
No, no. I knew who Microsoft was, but they came to campus. One of the things Microsoft did well and why it scaled up is they did college recruiting very early in Microsoft's cycle. At the time, Microsoft was about 200, 250 people, and they started recruiting on at least some college campuses starting in like 1981. So by that time, Microsoft was coming to Yale, and Microsoft ended up hiring me and six or seven of my classmates for the class of 83.
And so, what do you think? And you moved to Seattle, right?
I did, yes.
And what was that for someone who basically was an East Coast boy?
Well, I was an East Coast boy, but my mom was from California.
Right.
And we'd visited the Bay Area a bunch. So I thought, if you'd asked me, I thought maybe I'll end up in California. And all I knew about Seattle was I'd read Ball 4 when I was a kid, which was Jim Bouton's baseball book, primarily about the year that he was with the Seattle Pilots in 1969. So I knew that Seattle was a city that had and lost a baseball team. Fortunately, by the time I got there in 83, they had a new one because the Mariners started in 77 as part of an antitrust settlement for the Pilots moving to Milwaukee. So they had a baseball team, so that was a check. It was close to the West Coast. My parents ended up retiring to Northern California a couple years after I went out there, so that was sort of a check. And it was honestly that when everybody at Microsoft was incredibly smart, incredibly hardcore, and I thought, well, this place seems like it's got a lot of people that I want to work with and I could learn from, and I'll do it for a couple years until it gets boring, and it ended up being 10 years.
Okay, when you went to work there, it wasn't public yet?
No, it was. I was getting lucky, but better than good. So I got there in 83, and Microsoft went public in 86.
Okay, and what was your gig at Microsoft?
Well, I worked in basically three parts of the company. It was always about making products, because that's my passion. The first 4 years, I worked in the applications products. I was involved with... I didn't create Microsoft Word, but when I got involved with Word, Word was like number five in word processing and got it up to number two at the time, right behind WordPerfect, and we're kind of getting strong with them. And then I ran what was called program management for all the applications products, which is like the connective tissue between the marketers on the one hand and the engineers and the other. And since I had sort of a dual background, I was able to kind of play hopefully a constructive role in spanning the two. So it was my first 4 years. And then my next two, three years was working on networking products because I was always interested in communication, right? So networking is about understanding the plumbing and the infrastructure. So that was the least successful thing I worked on because at the time Microsoft was betting heavily on an operating system called OS2, and which was a joint venture formed between Microsoft and IBM. And Microsoft decided to build all its networking products on the OS2 platform. So I did it for a couple of years, worked with some great people. It was a fantastic lesson to me of how when you have a great team, great products, and a bad strategy, you fail, right? So a lot of the people I worked with ended up in different capacities having senior jobs in Microsoft for a number of years and doing cool things in the industry, but our products weren't that successful, where they generally were failures, because OS2 was not a viable platform to build networking servers on top of. Microsoft ended up being very successful in networking when it moved from OS2 to an operating system called Windows NT, which was the next generation, but that was after I left that group. So did that for a couple years, and then I worked in something we called multimedia and consumer systems, which was the last 3-4 years there, which was basically about figuring out how to add media technology into Windows and then starting working on the next sort of advanced digital, some of the early sort of proto-digital devices. So that was my last 3 or 4 years there, and ended up, it was a fantastic 10-year run. I learned a ton and made some lifelong friends, and and financially, it was obviously a very advantageous time to be there.
Okay, so financially, you know, if you read the literature, you did very well. Was that primarily getting in early, or your success in the operation, or?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was right place, right time, and then I did work my butt off and worked very closely with, you know, Gates and Ballmer and these other guys, and they, I think they viewed me as somebody who was hardcore, like, you know, would work 6-7 days a week without worrying about it, because I loved what I was doing. It was like I didn't have any family or kids at the time, so classic thing, you know, you're in your 20s, you throw yourself into your career, and had a great time with it. So it worked out very well for me, and you know, at the end of the 10 years, when I looked up and, you know, said, wow, this has been a decade, and pulled my periscope up, I was ready to do something else, but I was incredibly happy for the experience I had.
Okay, so what came first in terms of leaving? The concept that you were done and you've fulfilled your mission at Microsoft, or that you wanted to do Real Networks?
Well, I did have the idea for Real Networks. So I remember in the spring of 93, so I'm what, 31, and Gates comes to me and says, I want to reorganize some things. And I say, great, let's reorganize me out of a job, which I don't think was what he expected, but it was really was how I was feeling. I'd been working so hard, loving it, but I knew that I wouldn't really be able to step back and think about the next thing until I had some breathing room. I had to create some separation.
Just go back. When you were at Microsoft, the way you tell the story, you really were not a programmer.
No, I wrote very little code that ended up in Microsoft products. I was a technical enough person to help to work with the engineers and a marketing business-oriented enough person to understand, to go talk to customers, try to understand what the market wanted. And I always thought of myself as adding value at that intersection between those two.
Okay, so you wanted some breathing room. So you said, Bill, let's reorganize me out of a job.
Right.
And how did that go down?
So we had 3 meetings on the topic. The first meeting, he yelled at me, this is the most irrational thing. This is the stupidest thing. Why are you doing this? Why do you want to do this? Go talk to this guy and go talk to that guy. So fine, I did that. Second meeting was basically the same. Then the third meeting happened, and about 5 minutes into the third meeting, true story, I looked at him and I said, is this making you feel better? And he looked at me like I was crazy, because why would I say that? And I said, because if it is making you feel better, you should keep doing it, but it's not making me feel better and it's not changing my mind. And to his credit, he stopped cold. And we proceeded to have a very rational conversation about, you know, how we make a good transition, what we do. I ended up technically doing a leave of absence, so I spent 6 months traveling around the world and I took a class, thought maybe I'd go get a PhD, which I decided not to do. Then I did some consulting for Microsoft on a few topics related to what the intersection of the internet and Microsoft strategy should be, one related to future. There's this joint venture Microsoft was brewing called CableSoft, and I consulted with Bill on whether he should do this joint venture with the two big cable companies to try to create the dominant operating system for cable TV set-top boxes. So I did a little consulting at the back end of that, and at the time I was already brewing the idea for what became Real Networks, but it was really during that summer and fall of 1993 that I was figuring out what I was going to do next.
And when you left Microsoft, did you have enough money to never work again?
You know, if I was a monk, sure.
Okay. Okay, I got my answer.
But I figured, like, I was 31. I knew I had a lot of ambitions and things I was interested in doing, and ended up putting a bunch of the money into the company that became Real Networks. So it worked out just fine.
So how'd you come up with the idea for Real Networks?
Well, I had 2 ideas, actually, in the summer of 93. One was focused on this notion of set-top boxes and cable and television. As historians of this stuff remember, all the cable companies were talking about the 500-channel universe, that Time Warner had their big trial in Orlando, Florida. They were going to reinvent television. TCI, the other big cable company, had their own trials. The telcos had them. So we're like TeleTV, which was the thing that Howard Stringer was involved in. There were all these different trials. So I thought, well, maybe I'll make technology and products for those. And then at the same time, I thought, well, maybe there's something to this online communications world. I've been an online geek. One of the products I created at Microsoft was an online product called Microsoft Access before the database Microsoft Access. The first Microsoft Access was a communications product that was not that successful, but I'd worked closely with trying to create a consistent user interface behind CompuServe and AOL and the Prodigy and all these services. So I was very familiar with the online world. And I got lucky again. A good friend of mine named Mitch Kapoor asked me to get involved in a nonprofit he started.
Well, that was Lotus 1-2-3.
Right. I got to know Mitch through various interactions with Microsoft. Mitch was somebody and is somebody who cares about the intersection between technology and society. And Mitch is one of these people who's always understands stuff 5 years before anybody else does, both strategically and really more almost like conceptually. And Mitch was convinced that the internet was going to be a huge deal. Cyberspace was what most people called it at the time. And he created this organization called the Electronic Frontier Foundation that was very focused on issues of civil liberty and community in cyberspace. So Mitch asked me, and the time that I was technically on leave, but knew I wasn't going to go back to Microsoft. So in this late spring, early summer of 93, he said, come to a board meeting of the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And so I went to one of the board meetings in Austin, Texas, I think it was. And I met, and one of the guys there is this guy named Dave Farber, who really was one of the fathers of the internet, was telling everyone, hey, you got to try this Mosaic thing. So that's when I first saw the Mosaic web browser in a very early form that Mark Andreessen and his band of geeks at University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana were creating. So I downloaded Mosaic. I got an ISDN dial-in line to my home in Seattle. And I just all of a sudden saw, wow, this is the future. Because you would look at the web, you'd look at the web browser, and they had a web page called What's New with NCSA Mosaic. And at first, there'd be like one or two new web pages a week. Then there'd be like six new ones a week. Then there'd be like three a day. And it literally felt like I was looking at a Petri dish where the cells were multiplying rapidly. And it was clear that as the summer of 93 progressed and got into the fall of 93, that there was a huge thing happening that was going to be like a huge cultural phenomenon. And I had been very interested in media, of course, and had done a bunch of stuff around video and audio codecs in my work in multimedia at Microsoft. So I had the idea, what if I tried to do what Mosaic is doing for text and still graphics? What if we tried to do the same thing for audio and then video? And that's what the idea for Real Networks ended up being, and ended up incorporating it in February 94 and creating the first prototype in the summer of 94 and then launching in April of 95.
Okay, and did you raise money for Real Networks?
Yes. What I did was when I started, I took $1 million of my Microsoft grub stake, which was a high percentage of it, but not I didn't have to sell any houses or anything, or my one house. But I took $1 million, put it into the company, and told the four or five people I hired, we've got this much money to get to the next phase. So I was very lucky that I didn't have to go raise money. Then my friend Mitch Kapoor got excited about what I was doing, and in the fall of 94, winter of 95, Mitch made about a $2 million investment into Real Networks. And then we launched in April of 95. So I was able to bootstrap it with some of my grub stake from Microsoft. Mitch, because Mitch and I became close through the involvement with EFF, Mitch made the original angel investment. Then we launched, then we took our first venture round in the fall of 95 from a great firm called Excel and a guy named Jim Breyer, who's maybe on the second most famous investment, but he invested years later in this thing called Facebook that worked out pretty well for him too.
Okay, when you're starting Real Networks, how many people are working there?
So when we started, obviously it was just me, and then I cobbled together a team of three guys, only one of whom became a full-time employee to help build the prototype for what became Real Audio. And then by the time we launched in April of 95, we probably had 15 employees, something like that. One of the key guys I got was a guy named Phil Barrett, who was a key engineering leader in Windows, and was one of the unsung heroes of the success of Windows. Windows, if people know the history of Microsoft, had a very long gestation period, and it was basically a near failure. And Phil got involved in creating the first useful version of Windows called Windows 386, which allowed you to run multiple DOS apps on a 386, Intel 386 chip chip computer, and it was really useful. And then he and a couple of his guys created a version of Windows that solved the memory problem that Windows had, because Windows was really bad with using memory, because the PC had the Intel chip had a kind of a funny segmented memory architecture that made it hard, and they fixed that, and they created the core of what became Windows 3. So Phil was the unsung hero behind that, and I got him to come in, not technically as my co-founder, but as the technical leader of the company in the fall of 94, and then Phil led the team that launched Real Audio, and so I said we had about 15 people when we launched.
You're listening to my conversation with CEO of Real Networks, Rob Glaser, recorded live at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California. Hope you're enjoying listening to this episode of the Bob Lefsetz podcast. If you want to listen to sound bites from the interviews and see some of my guests, check it out at TuneIn or Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Now, more of my chat with the CEO of Real Networks, Rob Glaser, on the Bob Lefsetz podcast.
So if you go to the late 90s, Real Player is the standard. But if one were to pull back and look at the war, one would say, you may or may not agree, that's why I'm asking you, that Real Player ultimately lost the war.
Other than China, which we'll talk about in a minute, 100% true.
What did you learn there?
Well, we had a great run, and of course, I'm back running the company now, so we've lived to fight another day, and I think we have another renaissance coming up, which we can talk about. But one of the things I learned is that when you have a huge competitor that is threatened by you, you can try to do anything you can to avoid a head-on fight with that competitor, but at the end of the day, you just got to assume it's coming, and you've got to scale up massively to do that. So what happened is the following. So we got out there with Real Audio in 95, Real Video in 97, became the de facto market standard for a number of different use cases, of streaming audio, streaming video. We can talk about the music connection later. We started dabbling in music. And then Microsoft decided that both us, Netscape, and Java were existential threats to Microsoft. So they decided to do whatever they could to beat us. And they had a huge war chest of money to do it. They had willingness to use their power relationship with PC manufacturers in any way they needed to. And so they moved to essentially get PC manufacturers to ship their software and not ship our software, and to get media companies to use their software and not use our software. In the case of the computer manufacturers, they basically had a program where, let's say the price of a Windows license fee is $100. But they have a co-op program where if you ship Windows in the configuration they want, it only costs you $60. So let's say you sell 1 million PCs. So that's a $40 million difference in what you have to pay a year, and it's $40 million of pure margin at a low margin business. So all you have to do is what Microsoft tells you. So that's very powerful. So Microsoft was able to leverage the power of their monopoly to squeeze us out, to at the time squeeze the Netscape browser out and force Netscape to basically sell to AOL, also mess around with Java, and Java and JavaScript is a complicated history. But so we got basically squeezed, and the rational thing for us to have done at the time, if all we wanted to do was take our chips and go home, was to sell to the highest bidder, make it their problem, or sell to someone at such larger scale that they could fight the fight with us as a tool or a piece of it. But there's a few things, reason why I didn't do that. One is I actually wanted to try and build a company for the long term. I didn't want to just flip it and sell it. The second was a lot of things that happened concurrent with that. This is now around 99, 2000. You had the Intel, the internet bubble bursting at the same time. So you have the telecom bubble bursting, the internet bubble bursting, and this assault from Microsoft against antitrust violations, it turned out. Those three things had a very negative impact on us. We ultimately ended up not only surviving, but in a certain way prevailing. We started winning some antitrust legal cases against Microsoft, and they ended up settling with us for about $750 million. So we got it decent outcome from that standpoint, from the standpoint of shareholders. But we ended up also pivoting the company and reinventing the company in a few different ways. But, you know, if I had it to do over again, I would probably have found the safe, given that we didn't have the resources ourselves to compete head on with that attack, even though we were able to win legal settlements. They basically compensated us for the lost business, but they didn't replace the lost business, except in China. More on that in a minute. If we'd found the right safe port in a storm, that could have been interesting. It's not clear who they would have been, like in 2000, who would have been the player. Obviously, Netscape went to AOL. They got some money from a shareholder standpoint, but the browser didn't live, and AOL didn't even ultimately end up living, and now they get folded into Verizon. So it's not obvious. It depends how you're playing the game. If you're playing the game to make the most cash, the thing that Netscape did or that Mark Cuban did, where Mark sold his broadcast.com business to Yahoo for $4 billion and, you know, took the money and did other stuff with it. You could have done that, but I was trying to build something for the longer term.
So when did you buy the Pro Bowlers Tour?
So, okay, that's kind of a weird one, but it's true. So my friend Chris Peters was a Microsoft buddy of mine who got really into bowling. Chris is a much better bowler than me. He approached me and a third friend of ours, Mike Slade, more than 10 years ago. I have to remember how long ago it was. Probably 16, 17 years ago, and said, hey, I can buy the PBA out of bankruptcy or near bankruptcy that's been mismanaged. And bowling was one of my favorite sports as a kid. I was in a bowling league. I am a mediocre bowler, but I enjoy it to this day.
And you had a bowling lane in your house?
I used to have a bowling lane in my office.
Okay.
Yes, and Real Network's office in where we were for a decade, we had a bowling lane. When we moved to a top floor of a building, we didn't get a bowling lane there, but we did have a pair of bowling lanes in the building that we had in a neighborhood called Belltown in Seattle, and that was fun. So I love bowling, and I thought, okay, let's do this. And Chris ended up bowing out about 5 or 6 years ago. So now Mike and I are the owners of it. We got a really good guy named Tom Clark who runs it. If anybody wants to buy the PBA, I'm willing to sell it. But it makes a little money. It's nice to be a steward of something that you care about. The bowlers are all great human beings, but most of them are great human beings. And I'm happy that we're able to sustain a sport that is sort of at the center of Americana.
And is there any hope for bowling, or is it going to go extinct?
Well, bowling itself has never been more popular in terms of, like, you know, how many people a year bowl. Bowling leagues have had to reinvent themselves because there's this guy who wrote a book called Bowling Alone, which he sent me a copy of for sort of obvious reasons and talked to him once or twice, how bowling was tied to the industrial period where everyone worked the same shift and left the shift and then went and bowled that night, you know, sort of Laverne and Shirley style. And that culture doesn't really exist anymore. We have a much more, everybody's on their own schedule, much more scattered, both in more and more families, both parents work. So you have much less rhythm around that. So there is a core industry, like 4 million people who are bowling leagues, but it's down from whatever 10 million it used to be. But the number of people who bowl recreationally is up higher. Bowling's been reinvented. So how you actually connect professional bowling into that world where you have a lot of casual bowlers, but you don't have as many sort of league bowlers who identify with bowling as their sport. It's sort of an interesting thing to do. But we've managed to, you know, the PBA, we've been on, we've had a long run on ESPN. We're just moving to Fox. I think that got announced. I hope I'm not jumping the gun on that one. I don't think I am. And so I think we're going to have a good, you know, next run with the bowling. It's a fun thing. I'd only get to like one or two tournaments a year. I wish I get to more, but I have a pretty busy day job in between that and family.
Okay, so you're 1999 into 2000. There's hysteria, revolution in the music business, Napster. You have Real Networks. You ultimately decide to go in that business.
Right.
What is your thinking there?
Well, I believe that at the end of the day, there would be a legal streaming industry. I didn't know all the fits and starts and the twists in the road, but I had the belief that all this illegal, pirate stuff was going to be a phase the industry would go through, and the industry would figure it out. So I started having conversations with people in the music industry about this as early as like 95. I remember meeting Charlie Koppelman, who was when he was running EMI. Remember meeting senior folks in multiple labels. Nothing really came of those discussions. I remember having a conversation with Al Teller, who was running MCA at the time, and we were in the middle of conversation, and then Edgar Bronfman bought MCA, and it was clear there's going to be a new sheriff in town. So that there's a lot of that happened a few times. So then what happened was Sony and Universal decided to come together to create a joint venture that ended up being, first it was called Duet, then it'd be called Press Play. And we talked to them about using our technology, and they kind of wanted to build their own. So we put together a coalition of the three other majors at the time. There was EMI, Bertelsmann, because Sony and BMG hadn't merged yet, and Warner. And we also had AOL in there because it was after the AOL Time Warner. And we created a joint venture called MusicNet. And it was basically, it was the other three majors, and they had the two majors, so the two biggest. So they had about 40% of the content. We had about 40%, and there was about 20% that were indies that were licensed to both. And it was clear that that wasn't going to work. It was just one of the series of tactical maneuvers to create an opening for everything to get licensed to everybody. And so then what happened was there was a little company that had a product called Rhapsody. The product was called Listen, the company called Listen.com. And they ended up being like the Checkpoint Charlie of, if you remember in the Cold War, they'd exchanged prisoners over at Checkpoint Charlie in Berlin, right? The line between East Berlin and West Berlin. And Rhapsody was the Checkpoint Charlie, and that they were the first company that all five majors would license to. Because they didn't license to each other yet, because the lawyers were freaked out about that. But by creating sort of standard licenses that Rhapsody could have, Rhapsody became the first company that had licenses from all five majors. At the time, we owned 40% of MusicNet in a joint venture with the labels, and the board meetings were the most painful things. They were like the UN in terms of like everyone shows up with all these lawyers, the lawyers are making sure there's no antitrust collusion. Meanwhile, nothing gets done. So we had an opportunity to basically to buy Rhapsody because they were running out of money, and we believed in the space. So we basically bought Rhapsody and sold our 40% stake in MusicNet. So we sort of switched horses once all the licenses got cleared. And then basically at the time we bought Rhapsody, it had, 50,000 subscribers or something, and then we wrote it up as our vehicle. It's still going. We actually merged with Napster, and now we use the name Napster. We got 2.5 million subscribers, whatever it is. We've resized the staff, so it generates, so it's EBITDA positive. But we're not Spotify, we're not Apple. So there were some many lessons there, which we can talk about why that ended up. We still have a business that's got if you step back from the Spotify and obviously Apple, we're the largest independent company in the space, but a huge order of magnitude lower than the two big guys. And where that goes is an interesting question, but learned a lot of things along the way.
So isn't the real business being a white label service now, licensing your technology to third parties?
So the Napster business is a combination of white label and co-branded. It depends what partners want. So like, for instance, in the case of iHeartMusic, and we power their on-demand, iHeart wants to be the brand, and it says powered by Napster, but you don't necessarily see it prominently. Some of our other partners use the Napster brand more prominently. So it just depends. Like in Brazil, we have Vivo Musica. Vivo is the largest wireless carrier in Brazil, powered by Napster. So we use different brands in different parts of the world. We have a direct-to-consumer business, but it's the minority of the business. It's no longer the main business.
So you ultimately walk away from Real Networks to become a VC. What's the thinking there?
Well, these life changes always happen through a combination of personal reasons and professional reasons. I have three fantastic kids, twins who are almost 12, and the little guy, I call him little guy, he's almost 8. I've said this publicly, so I'm not speaking out of school here. Their mom, who I'm still get along with very well, had really bad postpartum depression. She wanted kids every bit as much as I did, and she is a fantastic mom, but she went through a really rough period. So my switching gears and focusing on being a dad for about 3 years was one of the best things I ever did in my life. It probably wasn't the best thing for Real Networks because we tried two other people running the company who were kind of like the drummer in Spinal Tap, unfortunately, if that's a music analogy people know. But it was appropriate for me personally to really go deep in family, and my kids are doing great, great partner. My ex is doing super well. The kids go back and forth between the two, and I don't know that we could have gotten there if I had stayed, you know, full-time at Real Networks the whole way through.
And were you basically a house dad, or were you a VC during that period?
So I was this thing called a venture partner, it's a little bit like the master's thesis I wrote on economists. If you want to be a VC, if you think you might want to be a VC, if you go be a venture partner at a firm, you learn a lot. So Accel is an incredible firm. You know, they invested, you know, I mentioned us, but Facebook is probably their signature huge investment. They've had many other successes over the years. You can go look at their website. And so what I would do is I would go down to partner meetings once or twice a month, and I would kibitz and give them feedback. I probably made 3 or 4 investments with them. I probably made, you know, in the period when I was actively investing, I probably made 15, 20 investments. Maybe a quarter of them with Accel and a quarter of them either on my own or with other venture entities. I ended up deciding that I'm not wired to be a good VC. I like angel investing, which is very different than being a VC. But when you're a VC, it's this weird mix of you got a partnership, you're all running shared money, but you're each individual responsible for a deal. And if the chemistry is great with the partners, I'm sure it can be great, but it's very easy for these partnerships to fracture depending on, like, you know, which deals work, which deals don't work, who gets credit for them, who doesn't get credit for them. And to me, I much prefer to do individual angel investing, which I do very little of nowadays because I'm too busy. I do a little bit of it. I prefer that to being part of a professional venture fund. But I only know that because I spent a couple years sort of sitting around the table with the Accel guys as they did their thing.
So at this late date, what are the main products of Real Networks, and where is the company going?
So Real Networks has 4 major growth initiatives going forward. And you could say it's a late date, but for some of these initiatives, it's actually super early. One is a consumer initiative that's actually in the games business. We had a games business that we spun up in the 90s. It did well for a while, and then it lay fallow. And then I brought back 2 of the entrepreneurs that helped create the European business. It's called Gamehouse. It's actually based in the Netherlands, and it's at the intersection of casual gameplay and storytelling. So we have now about 2 dozen what we call these Gamehouse original stories. And we're in the process of launching a subscription product around them. For the first couple of years, we didn't have enough to make a subscription, so we sold them individually, built a decent business on it. It's about a $25 million business, something like that. But now with subscriptions, we're pretty optimistic that we can grow it significantly. And the team doing that, Rutger Peters and Eric Goossens are the 2 guys who run it jointly. They're fantastic entrepreneurs. They kind of both do both, but Eric is more of the creative spark, and Rutger is more of the business guy, although they both do both, and they'd probably blanch at my pigeonholing them in that way. But they work together collaboratively. They do a fantastic job. Love working with them. And that business, I think, I'm very optimistic about its future as a subscription business. Then we have 3 B2B products, which is something Real's always had a foot in both. We make technology. We love consumers. The one that, when I said remember China, the one that's the most obscure, but it's true, is we have a robust business of licensing video compression technology in China. When I came back, it was clear that what happened is, and I'll explain why. When Microsoft displaced us with this thing I told you about, where they go to PC manufacturers and they say, you only have to pay us $60 per Windows if you do what we say, $100 otherwise, the Chinese manufacturers, companies like Legend, which became Lenovo, or Great Wall, or some of these others, they basically told Microsoft, you know, I only shipped 100,000 PCs this year, here's your money. And when Microsoft said, no, we think you shipped 1 million, they're like, you know, maybe I only shipped 50,000. So Microsoft had less leverage in the Chinese market circa 2000 to use this tactic of using their marketing card program to push us out of the market. So we never got displaced in the Chinese market. So our video format, which is called RMVB, continues to be very popular. So about 3 years ago, three or four years ago, I spun up a team, or I commissioned the team to be spun up, to build a next-generation video technology. We put half the R&D team in Seattle, half in Beijing, and we have a next-generation video technology called RMHD that is doing very well in China. We have a partnership with one of the three largest broadcasters in China called CIBN. Their affiliate just launched in the first phase of launch in China. So that business is going to do very well, basically licensing video technology that's next-generation technology. It's better than the next-generation MPEG. It's very competitive with the best in the world. Whether we bring that technology from China to the rest of the world, we'll see. It's something we want to do, but we've got to get into the chipsets. We've got to build out the infrastructure first. So those are two businesses. The third business is actually very obscure, but it's very interesting. It's around messaging. Do you know how much like robocalling and spam you're getting on your phone? We built a product called Context that's designed to cut down on text spamming and then also providing a way for message providers to classify their messages to basically create more structure around them. A lot of stuff that's done in email and not done in texting. The reason we got in that business is we have a related business that is the power what's called inter-carrier messaging. So if you're on Verizon and I'm on AT&T and I send you a text, it goes over our inter-carrier messaging software. So we have the software that is the highly reliable but invisible layer that about 1.5 billion messages a day travel over. So that team used that expertise to build this next product, which is called Context, and that's just rolling out. And then the fourth, which may be the coolest of them all, is a computer vision platform called RealCV, which leverages all of our expertise in video technology to do phenomenal face recognition. We haven't yet described what markets we're going after that, but we've got some fantastic ideas that we think are going to make people really happy to have computer-based face recognition be applied, not in creepy situations, but in situations where it's actually good for society to have people know who's who.
Okay. You're also very heavily political. If one follows your Twitter feed, most of it is politics. You invested in Air America. So what was your thinking of the Air America, and where are you relative to politics today?
Well, so the reason I got involved in Air America, and that goes back over a decade, is I was very frustrated by the rise of Fox News and the right media, that there was no longer any kind of balance, because you had the mainstream media, which is very much covers the horse race, tries to have journalistic ethics, etc., and then you had Fox operating as kind of a rightward magnet that was not operating within journalistic bounds, in my view, even back then, but was sort of being a like talk radio on television. You also had a lot of right wing talk radio. So the question was, why can't there be a progressive alternative just to rebalance society? So I got to know somebody who we may talk about in a minute, Al Franken, through some people I knew. And Al was interested in getting involved in this fledgling thing called Air America. And he asked me for advice. And I said, well, Al, I think you should do it. I think you'll be fantastic. You know, Al had already, he'd done Saturday Night Live. He'd written some books that were very compelling. And I thought Al was somebody who could really have a big impact. But I said, I don't know about the people that are backing it. I don't know if it has the resources. Anyway, so through Al, I allowed myself to get sucked in and became for a while the chairman of this thing. And it was it was financially not very robust. There's this old expression, right? You know, the patient operation was successful, but the patient died. That's kind of like what happened with Air America, because through Air America, we created something that had critical mass around progressive media. Rachel Maddow came from Air America. She was one of our up-and-coming stars, and obviously Al played a huge role in it. There were a few other folks that are less famous that came up through the ranks there. The whole way MSNBC started came out of the ashes, if you will, of Air America. So it was not a good use of capital from the standpoint of making money, but I kind of knew that. But I think it did play a catalytic role. It took a while. In 2004 was when it started. It didn't move the meter enough to change the outcome there. But over time, I think we do have more, you know, be it the Huffington Post, be it MSNBC, more outlets that are that give voice to progressive ideas and values. So I'm not involved in it anymore, but I'm glad I did it, even though it was from a cash-on-cash standpoint, it was a bad investment.
Okay, so the big issue today in technology is privacy. So what's your viewpoint on what's going on there with privacy and data?
I think that the reckoning that's happening now is important and has to happen. I think that you remember Facebook's used to have their slogan, move fast and break stuff. I don't think they meant to break democracy, but I think that's largely what happened. It happened because it became too easy for bad actors, probably Cambridge Analytica being one of those bad actors, to scoop up huge amounts of data on people that can be used to both target them and influence them in all kinds of pernicious ways. And so from my standpoint, we need to have much more rigorous laws and enforcement of those laws around data privacy. And you know, for instance, this new European law, GDPR, which I think becomes effective like about a month from now, I think it's middle end of May, I think is a huge step forward in the right direction. What I'm seeing is a lot of companies are actually used, because Europe is such a big part of their business, whatever policies they're putting in place for Europe, they're putting in place globally. But I think the U.S. should have its own GDPR law, not rely on the Europeans, right? You know, we wouldn't say, well, the Europeans are taking care of air traffic safety, we don't need our own air traffic safety standards. Of course we do. And maybe they'll be the same as Europe, maybe they'll be a little different or something, but we should have our own, you know, equivalent of GDPR in the U.S. 100% absolutely agree with that. In terms of what it would mean in practice, I still think most people would be willing to use these social media services and would use the ad-supported versions of them. The approach that I've taken is I don't think I've had, I think every post I've ever posted on Facebook, I've basically put Twitter rules on it. I assume that it's public. Because my assumption is anything I post, if I share it with 50 friends, I've shared it with the world anyway. So I don't post pictures of my kids on social media, just as a matter of, you know, personal preference, personal choice and privacy. If I want to send pictures of my kids, I email them to my friends, and I trust that they're not going to, you know, post them on social media. Anything I post publicly, I assume, you know, I'm going to have to live with it 20 years from now. If I said something obnoxious about Trump and, you know, Trump gets the Nobel Prize or something, I'm going to have to eat crow. That's possible. My assumption was in, now, well, this is an interesting thing. So my daughter is now 11, she rides a school bus because she now goes to a Catholic girls' school that she has to take a bus to go to. It's fantastic, cool, great for her. But now she needed a phone. So she was like, well, Dad, can I have an iPhone? She's 11 years old. I said, no. So I got her a five-year-old LG flip phone with a Kex keyboard, which you can buy on eBay, by the way. And she's mad at me about this. This is like the biggest, like, and so she's like, Dad, all my friends have iPhones. And I said, what about Andy's daughter? Andy's a guy I worked with at Microsoft. And I know that Andy is also vigilant about this stuff. And she said, well, Andy's dad won't even let Naomi get a flip phone for two more years. And I said, well, why don't we go to lunch with Andy and his daughter and talk about this? And I said, no, Dad, we don't need to do that. So my point is that a lot of how to make social media healthy for kids and not unhealthy is actually parents understanding that there are choices. The choice isn't give them an iPhone or not. You know, yeah, you got to go out of your way to find a five-year-old flip phone, but it works just fine. She can text and call us, which is all at the age of 11 I want her to do. When she's 13, I'm sure she'll have an iPhone. We'll probably have policies on, you know, that she has to show us all of her texts. I'm sure she'll get around them in some ways. But the perniciousness of social media comes with the interaction between the fact that most people don't understand what this stuff is, and the fact that the large-scale companies running it were too willing to take advantage of that naivete. So I don't think the solution is no social media. I think the solution is better regulation and better education.
We'll pause here for a brief moment and get right back to CEO of Real Networks, Rob Glaser. As you know, I'm a writer, and you can read my work at leftsets.com. In addition to reading my commentary on music, tech, and the world at large, you'll be the first to find out when we've published a new podcast. Go to leftsets.com and sign up for the newsletter. Now, more with CEO of Real Networks, Rob Glaser, recorded live at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California.
Okay, it's time for questions from the audience. Raise your hand. Jim has a microphone. And please talk into the microphone and ask a question as opposed to making a statement.
Okay, before the first question, quick story. So when we were about to reach out to Rob about coming here, I spelled his name with a Z, and I get this note from Bob, you know, chastising me, like, dude, you got to spell people's names correctly if you're going to. And so then Rob gets here today and looks at his name tag, and it has two S's. So I have to apologize for that and take ownership of it, and I don't know how it happened.
Well, I'll tell you a story about my daughter, which, since I don't show pictures of the internet, so her name is Eva, E-V-A, and it turns out that in the current generation, that's a moderately popular name, but apparently because of Reese Witherspoon, Ava, A-V-A, is like one of the five most popular girl names. So about 5 years ago, when she was 6 years old, she goes through TSA, and the TSA guy looks at her and says, Ava Glaser. And she looks back at him, TSA guy, you know, she doesn't know she's not supposed to sass him. She says, actually, it's Eva. And the TSA guy apparently isn't used to being sassed by six-year-old kids, hands her back the passport and in a kind of exaggerated way says, excuse me, Eva. And then her reply is, actually, it's a common mistake. So it's actually a common mistake.
Okay. I have a couple technical questions. So tracking all the video technology that you've been doing since 93, 94, 95, where do you think the technology is moving with, like, AI and, like, fake app and all that stuff that's going on, and how big a problem is that going to be? And then following up on that with AI and the Sergey Brin founder's letter about saying responsibilities in AI, where are you seeing AI and what's your feeling on that?
Well, the first one's easier than the second one, because the second one is, like, so open-ended. You know, you get to the, you know, the Elon Musk debates with everybody about stuff and Sergey. So there's going to be a really interesting convergence in the next 5 years between CG, computer graphics, and natural video. We already see it today with augmented reality, because if you think about what augmented reality is, it's reality where you take a video and you superimpose in some way something that looks very lifelike that is not actually in the scene. And so augmented reality is incredibly powerful, you know, with lots of utility for it, but it also means that you can no longer trust the authenticity of an image or an experience. And that's been going on for a while. I mean, people have been, you know, retouching photos for years. You know, the whole, you could argue that, People Magazine and the like are pure examples of the fact you can't trust a photograph, where the images they show of people looking far more beautiful than they ever could look or have looked. But it's going to get worse, and it's going to apply to video. I think we'll probably have to come up with some authentication techniques on video that involve some combination of triangulation and watermarking. And by triangulation, I mean literally where you get the same image with the same time code from multiple cameras and multiple vantage points, and then you have those watermarked by some kind of trust authority, so you know that that's the image of what really happened. And the and that's that whole how you create trust authorities that people respect for factual things is a huge problem we have already in text and quote unquote fake news, and it's going to get even worse as this connection between computer generated video and natural video gets deeper and deeper. But hopefully we'll solve that problem, because and we're living in weird times, right? Because at the same time there's all this forensic stuff that gets done, like the Golden State Killer got caught because of consumer DNA websites that were used by law enforcement to track relatives of the guy. So that's a case where data was used to solve a crime, that where you actually were able to combine gumshoe work with data, and he'll go to a trial, and he's guilty, innocent or proven guilty, but sounds like he's probably the guy, and they got him through science that authentically figured out who he was based on DNA from 30 years ago that got put in a vault somewhere. So there's cross currents here, but I do think for video we're going to have to create strategies for validating authentic video rather than just looks realistic to me, because sometimes it might be just a brilliant fake. On the second point about AI, there's no question that there are certain categories of jobs that will be massively disrupted by AI. Let's take like a radiologist, for instance. The best radiologists can find things that that mediocre radiologists can't find. And the best AI system can probably find things that the best radiologists can't find. Is that good for society? Yes, it's good to have better radiology. Is it good for radiologists? Probably the best ones will still do fine. Probably the mediocre ones will find that instead of their job being outsourced to India, their job got outsourced to a computer. So there's going to be economic disruption from AI for sure. I don't know that I take the view that, you know, we're going to have the problem that you had in 2001 with HAL, where they're going to take over. I think that's a little bit of a stretch. But I think the economic disruption that's going to come from AI is going to be huge. But I think it takes longer than you think. Like, for instance, I'm personally quite bearish on self-driving cars. I think it's not going to... I think self-driving cars as a phenomenon replacing taxi drivers won't happen... before 2050, let's say. And that's a bearish view compared to some. There'll be scenarios where augmentation is good. Like, for instance, you're driving and you start to fall asleep. It'll save a bunch of lives in that case. That's a good thing. Somewhat that'll be maybe because it notices your breathing pattern and it wakes you up by giving you a little bit of a shake. Maybe it'll be because it prevents you from steering into a rail and then it wakes you up. But pure, that's augmentation. So I'm bullish on that. Big picture, I'm a technology optimist. I mean, I called my company Progressive Networks before we ended up changing to Real Networks. My foundation is the Glaser Progress Foundation. I believe in the idea of progress, but I don't think it's an unguided missile. I think you got to make very conscious social choices on how you use the technology.
Question over here. Two things. One is recently on, I think it was on CNN, they were showing some augmented video of Obama, but they were interviewing a company that actually has software to detect that. So maybe there's a future with those companies embedding their software. But secondly, I don't know if anyone else has this question, but you worked for Microsoft all those years. When you had to deal with them trying to basically bury you, didn't you at any point reach out to them and see if we could make a deal?
In fact, I did. I skipped over that story. I mean, Bob asked amazing questions, but you can only cover so much stuff. So in what happened in 90, in, remember the year's right. So in 97, we came out with Real Video. And then later that year, or was it 98? I think it was 98. We heard that Microsoft was about to buy our biggest competitor, a company called VXtreme. And so we went to Microsoft and we said, rather than buying VXtreme, why don't we do a deal with you? And so we did a licensing deal where we sold Microsoft 10% of our company, licensed them our technology, gave them an opportunity to buy another 10% of our company, and gave them an opportunity to buy another license to us in order to create a common roadmap. And that was a deal done in good faith with very senior people at Microsoft. What happened then was just one of those unfortunate things, and we had a plan B for it, but what happened was Microsoft gave the responsibility of that deal to the guys whose job previously was to compete with us, and they hated our guts. And so they did everything they could to try to put us out of business. They took the software, the license from us, and they gave it away for free, trying to crater our server business. And we got around that by coming out with a new version of the product 3 months later that meant they were giving away day-old milk for free. And so there was a lot of back and forth and maneuvering. We took a shot at trying to be aligned with them. We meant it sincerely. We were not trying to get into the PC operating system business. We weren't trying to be a hostile competitor of theirs. But we did not manage to get the team that received the deal, licensing deal, to feel good about it. That's life. So we took our best shot at trying to stay aligned with them. And then years later, we actually didn't end up initiating the lawsuit until 3 or 4 years later, because I kind of wanted us to stabilize the company. And you know, the way these suits work is you can look back 3 or 4 years. So we waited until we were stable and we were still in the look back period. And that's when we started the lawsuit. And ultimately, we settled the lawsuit. I sat down with Gates and we did the final negotiation. Some very senior people on both sides were involved. So we ended up settling without going to court. We started in court. We didn't finish in court. We settled, you know, a year or two into the lawsuit and got a good outcome and moved on.
Okay. Any other questions? Jim, you have the microphone?
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, my name is Vicki Nauman, and I actually worked at MusicNet back in the day.
Great.
And it, just a side anecdote, one of the first meetings I had was with Warner Music wanting to license us tracks at $4.95 wholesale.
Good deal.
And that was a point where I thought, oh, okay, this is going to take a while. But my question for you is there's a school of thought that there's only one Apple, there's only one Google, there's only one Facebook. In music, what are your thoughts about there's only one Spotify, there's only one streaming service? Right now we have a commoditization of all of the catalogs, and I'm just interested in what your view is in the landscape for music.
Well, I would say the following. Spotify has done an incredible job, and I have huge respect for Daniel and folks like Troy was here yesterday, what they've done. They were able to succeed in a particular context, and it may be useful for this group to explain that. I thought maybe Bob would ask about this. Spotify was able to get to scale because they started in Europe for a very particular reason. So we launched in the U.S. Between us, which was Rhapsody at the time, Napster, a few others, we had over 1 million subscribers. We did a teeny bit of effort in Europe, but not much of it. In the early days, Europe was very expensive because you had to license country by country, and of course, every country has its own repertoire, where 60-70% of the repertoire in most countries is local language, local culture. So it was much more expensive to launch in Europe. At the time that Spotify launched, Europe, if US had 1 million paid subscribers, Europe maybe had 100,000. It was tiny. So Spotify was able to go to the majors and get a much more flexible deal for their free to premium offer, their premium offer, than we could ever get in the US. We begged the labels for that deal. The best deal we could get from the US labels was what we called Rhapsody 25, which was a non-subscriber could listen to 25 streams a month and then would have to pay. And that turned out maybe we were lousy marketers, but I think that was much harder to market than the Spotify pre-product. So Spotify launched and got to critical mass in Europe with a free offer that was much, much more robust than any free offer that we were able to get the U.S. labels to provide. Now, then Spotify came to the U.S., and Spotify already had the momentum from Europe, and they basically said to the majors, we want to do the same deal in the U.S., and it took 2 years to get the deal done because the majors kept saying no. Finally, Daniel raised $100 million, basically paid it to the labels, and he got a pretty similar form of that deal. Good for him, incredible for him, but that's a huge reason why Spotify became the king of the industry, was because it had the bootstrap in Europe, and by the time it got into the U.S., it had the financial structure to raise $100 million, like at $1 billion valuation or something. So it was 10% of the company. Ended up, obviously, they've created a lot of economic value since then. They don't have the cash flow yet, but they have the economic value. In terms of what happens next, vis-a-vis Spotify and the labels, I think the big question is, what happens to the current detente, right? Spotify, it's been widely reported, I have no proprietary information on this, has contractually agreed they're not going to be a label, right? So they can only go so far. They can renegotiate margins, try and get more profitability. But at the end of the day, their biggest power as a distributor is to leverage that into being a label. And how that plays out is, to me, the unwritten story of the next 5 years, which is, will Universal and Sony and Warner, which are the three big labels and that control a huge amount of the catalog, end up getting, I don't know what the right word would be, squeezed by Spotify needing to have more control of repertoire. Now, Spotify has tried to branch out in video, tried to branch out in adjacent areas, but insofar as Spotify stays an independent company, they have to make a move like that somehow, sometime in the next 5 years, or they're ultimately their model is going to be compromised unless they sell to somebody else that's at massive scale. So, you know, there's all these things that haven't played out yet. If I knew the answer to that question, I'd know the answer to your question, which is, what happens next? Right? You know, you've got Spotify at 70 million and change, whatever number Troy told you yesterday, Apple at 40 and change, whatever their latest number is. And then, you know, everybody is much, much lower than that. Amazon is sort of a wild card because they have 100 million Prime users, and they've got a catalog, you know, mediocre product for them, and then they've got a premium product that has many, many fewer users. But it's very stratified. And if I were a major, I would view that as a very, very dangerous, unstable place to be for the reason that I just described. So if I was a major, I'd be doing everything I could that's ethical and legal to make sure there are three or four other scale competitors so that when Spotify comes to you for the next renewal cycle and wants to jam you, wants to get out of this, we can't be a label thing, whatever, you'd have the ability to walk away. But if there's a certain point, if Spotify is half of the major's revenue, that's going to be unbelievably hard for them to do. And we're getting to that point. I don't know what the math is today, but Spotify is obviously a majority of their streaming revenue, and streaming is a majority of their revenue. So it doesn't take too much for Spotify to literally be a majority of their revenue as a whole, in which case the labels, you know, the power dynamic can shift. So if I were a label, I would be trying to encourage as many people as possible to create as much diversity as possible. We have that conversation, we meaning Napster, with Sony, with Warner, with Universal. They get it. But then there's a question of how you activate it.
Okay.
Rob, I'm aware of your interest in what happened in 2016 vis-a-vis Russia and their involvement in our elections. Looking forward to 2018 and 2020, what do you anticipate the things that we ought to be, you know, looking out for and anticipating vis-a-vis their chicanery?
I'll explain what you said for folks who know. So in the summer of 16, I started a website called PutinTrump.org. And it's not because I have a crystal ball. It's because I was just pattern matching, which is one of the things that I do, right? And it was clear to me that there was something really weird happening when the Republican convention softened in their platform. They softened their program to be anti-Ukraine and pro-Russia, whereas the Republican Party had been the harder core ones, particularly when Mitt Romney was running, the harder core anti-Russia party. So there was something weird going on there. There's all the stuff about, all of the money laundering-ish things that happen with high-end real estate and Trump that has been reported on. And I didn't know anything about tapes of random things that happened in Moscow or any of that stuff. I didn't know anything about I heard rumors about being the Steele documents, the Steele dossier in the fall of 16 after we launched the website, but I didn't know anything about it at the time we launched it. But it was clear that there was something weird going on here, and I wanted to just shine a light on it. So we created a website, didn't put a huge amount of money behind it, but publicized it a bit, got some attention for it. But at the end of the day, there were so many other massive trends that were driving the election of Trump over Hillary. Looking to 2018, there's no question in my mind that there is going to be a lot of effort by the Russian government to influence the elections where they can. They're going to have one disadvantage relative to 16, which is you can't write the same national fake news and fake social media postings that you could in 2016, A, because hopefully the Facebooks and the Twitters of the world are more vigilant, and B, because it won't be one national issue. What wins that swing state congressional district in Ohio will be specific to two Ohio candidates that most of us have never heard of. The same thing, so it'll be district by district. But I do think that who wins Congress in 2018 is the binary issue for the next 2 years. You know, if Democrats win control of the House of Representatives, there are going to be robust hearings. There's going to be a robust process. And I think it's highly likely that in 2019, Trump will be impeached. Now, the Democrats are afraid to say that because they don't want to make it sound like they're not going to be data-driven. I say that because I think that what the data would expose between the Mueller axis and the Michael Cohen sleazy stuff and who knows what else is that Trump has committed a series of acts that are impeachable offenses. But we don't have all the data yet. We have certain things that are suggestive of that. But I think when we get the data, we'll see what happens. My personal belief is when we get the data, it'll demonstrate the need to impeach him, and that should then happen. Then the interesting question will be what happens in the Senate, and does Trump cave then, or does he stay and fight? Different people have different views of that. I don't think it's a foregone conclusion either way. If you study 73, 74, it was the smoking gun tapes that ultimately caused Republicans in the Senate to flip and made Nixon resign, whereas, of course, in 99, with the 98-99 Monica Lewinsky stuff, it was 98 stuff, it was clear that Clinton had perjured himself over a blowjob, which was wrong. I think you can have an interesting debate about whether that's an impeachable offense or not, but I think the Democrats didn't feel under political pressure to call it an impeachable offense, and therefore he's finished his term out. So I don't know how it's going to go beyond that, but I think the 18 election will be the limit. If the Democrats don't win the House in 18, we'll just have two more years like the last 2 years, the last year and a half.
Okay. I have another political-minded question, and that's if the right has media, and they have media at scale with Fox News, and then they have the biggest, you know, tweeter of all time that's really dominating the headlines. Based on your experience with Air America, what can the left do to create a media engine communication strategy moving forward that can rival what the right is doing at scale and to communicate what the Democrat or what the left represents? And then also, how does that intersect with technology? Is it like what the crooked media guys are doing, but just at scale? And if you were to say, I'm gonna launch Air America for 2018, what would that company look like, and what would that communication strategy be?
Well, I have thought about conceptually, but not operationally, what it would be. I think it actually, if you look at the fact that Trump's popularity is still below 40%, I think it's all about marshaling electoral critical mass from people who want our country to work the way it's supposed to work. So I don't think the right thing to do is to fight their boisterous propaganda and name-calling and frequently lies with the same. I think the right thing to do is to appeal to anybody that thinks that our democracy is too important to allow truth to become a subjective thing, that our societal cohesion is too important to allow facts to be irrelevant. And if you just say, look, this is just about what the facts are, right? You know, climate change, there's an incontrovertible scientific consensus around this. That's a fact. The data on what weather is happening, that's a fact. And yes, it's unfortunate for people in the extractive industries that those facts are there, but those are facts. So I think if we just literally stick to the facts and being unyielding about raising those facts in the face of name calling, in the face of ad hominem attacks, in the face of whatever else, I think that's the greatest chance to restore some balance to the political discourse and to the checks and balances. I mean, the big tragedy of 2016 wasn't just Trump's election, but the fact that one of the other branches of government that's supposed to be a check and balance has completely abdicated that responsibility. And it's abdicated that responsibility because the politics for Republicans are that they feel like if they don't, they'll get primaried and they'll lose. And if they do, they'll get to keep playing ball. So it's unfortunate that is the dynamic we have, but the only solution to that dynamic is to not have them being have the levers of power, and to do that, we got to persuade a lot of independents that change has to happen, and if we do that, then I think that will build on itself.
Okay.
Back to your last question.
Right.
The question was about music and VR. I am medium bearish on VR because the ergonomics of using a VR headset and an experience are not, it's so immersive that it is not, doesn't fit in a wide enough swatch of life. Everyone got excited about 3D because you could go to watch a James Cameron movie in a movie theater. But that's an intended immersive experience where for 2 hours you're focusing, you're going to a location, you're watching it. Home 3D didn't work because people don't put glasses on to watch movies at home because they're watching in such a range of different ways. So, you know, until you have the equivalent of direct view VR, I think it's going to be more of a niche thing than people realize. So do I think that there are ways to do much more immersive experiences with live music shows? Absolutely. And there's lots of different techniques for doing that. Do I think people are going to put VR headsets on to watch concerts? It makes for a great demo, but you know the headset fatigue thing is a real phenomenon, and the ergonomics of using these devices have to be compelling. One of the angel investments that I've done that I'm proudest of in the last couple of years is a company called Control Labs, which Stephen Levy wrote up, did a nice write-up of it in Wired magazine. It's a brilliant guy named Thomas Reardon, who I've known for many years, and his band of neurobiologists. And they've created a technology that lets you have an armband that you basically, think of it as like an Apple Watch or a next-generation Fitbit, where the band can literally detect individual electron signals, neurological signals, from your brain to your fingers. So it can tell what you're doing here with your individual fingers with a band that sits on your wrist. Something like that, where the technology is not invasive, you don't have to wear a big data glove, I think is going to be hugely important for the input side of all this AR-VR stuff. And we need the equivalent of the output side of that, where you can get an immersive experience without having to wear an immersive headset. And I think the AR plus path is probably a better path for achieving that, in my view, than the immersive headset experience, which make for incredible demos, but I don't think people really want to be in that gear for that long.
Okay, let that be a lesson. You don't have to be limited to one vertical. Rob, as we've owns the Pro Bowlers Tour, is involved in music, technology, and politics. Thanks so much for being here and sharing your ideas with the audience.
Thanks a lot.
That wraps up this week's episode of the Bob Lefsetz podcast, recorded live at the Music Media Summit in Santa Barbara, California, and produced by TuneIn. I hope you enjoyed this conversation with CEO of Real Networks, Rob Glaser, and his interactions with Asia and his history with Bill Gates and Microsoft. What did you think of the interview? Email me at bob@lefsetz.com. Until next time, I'm Bob Lefsetz.